Today we have four incredible panelists that all have over 25 years of experience that are going to share with you. First, I would like to announce that today is our first panelist's birthday and is now officially considered an old-timer, Dorian G. from Sacramento.
I'll be damned. She put that in there. I'm Dorian G. from Sackypaw.
Hi, Dorian. We love you, Dorian. Lots.
Whole bunches.
And I am an alcoholic. Absolutely. Today is 25 years. I've seen it in my pocket. Just in case I start crying again, I was the newcomer who cried all the time, and that's been true ever since. And I appreciate the old timers who turned to me when I cried and I felt ashamed or embarrassed, or I would have flashbacks to my childhood where if you cried, you got beat, and they would just say, more tears out, more God in. And I've never forgotten that. And so then, around year seven, I ended up, my sponsor sent me to counseling, and the counselor said, you got a lot of tears to cry, and I thought, shit, I need a lot of God. And it's been true. It's been absolutely true. I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous through anything other than being a drunk on the street and being brought into these meetings. And I am very grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous does not throw the drunk in the meeting out. That's me. I smelled like shit because I was probably shitting my pants. I peed on myself. I had wounds. I was in toxic bloat. I saw stuff you didn't see. And my mind would go to all kinds of ideas, you know. And it still does, but I don't act on them as often these days. But you guys did not tell me I couldn't come back. You said, keep coming back. And so I'd come back drunk again. You said, keep coming back, and I'd come back drunk again. This went on, the old timers in Sacramento tell me, from June of 1986, and clearly I didn't get sober until November. And what happened was I was going to one group in Sacramento, and when you guys would be talking, and you use, because there's AA language, and you guys would be talking, and if I didn't understand, I'm an excellent student. I was one of those people who got the straight A's. I was a performing ballerina. I went off to Cal Poly. I mean, I was a great student. But, so I knew, and so I would raise my hand. Until you called on me. You say, what? And I say, what's the sponsor? And you tell me, go on a little bit more. And you tell me. And what happened, though, was I was drunk when you were answering my questions. So I'd come back to the meeting in Green Haven the next day. And so finally, after a while, they picked a little old-timer, little dude named Phil. And he said, I'll walk you to your car. And so he walks me to the car, and he hands me a piece of paper about this big. He goes, we at the Green Haven group drew you a map. Here you go. And I looked at it, and he said, it's how to get to this group called Group 3. We think you need to go there. And I thought, wow, cool. And he said, because they have beginner's meetings. And I am a real believer in beginner's meetings. The old-timer Doc, and Doc actually wrote HALT, and he was a member of the people that made themselves my home group, and he used to always say, you know what, don't join anything you don't know what it is. You know, it's different when we're tossed into jail or we're tossed into a detox, etc. But when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there's some tricky stuff here, real friggin' tricky. Number one, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, you ain't. End of discussion. It doesn't matter what the world is telling you. Because this program works for people that self-diagnose. So it doesn't matter what some other people are saying. And they said, another thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is these steps, if you're not a real alcoholic, why would you do them? You know what I mean? So, so as a result, I got sent to Group 3, and Phil told me, hey, it's a beginner's meeting over there on Thursday nights at 6, and it still is, so if you're ever in Sacramento on a Thursday, contact group 3, find out where it is. It's right off Highway 50, and go to the 6 p.m. beginners meeting. And he said, but you know, when you go over there, you know, because you were kind of raised, I was raised on the upside of the dollar bill. And he said, you know, and it's kind of in this part of town, so, you know, parking under some light or something and be safe. And I knew what that meant. So that Thursday came up, and I got my Gucci bag, and I put my loaded 38 in there, and I went to my first beginners meeting. And I carried a gun with me to every friggin' meeting and conference for the first year. That's the kind of place I came from. If any of you saw the movie, I think it's called American Gangster, and there's the part where the party's going on, and this guy was acting inappropriately and got his head smashed in the piano, welcome to my house. My dad was an old gangster. And so I was raised with really strict rules, but I was also taught what I believe are really good things, like how to use a gun. Also, how to fix a car. Because the whole objective when you're raised in that environment is know a little bit about everything and know how to handle yourself without relying upon anybody, ever. So I get to this program, I don't talk. I don't look at you. There's nothing to friggin' smile about to where by then, you know, I had developed my own life. I mean, I found Cal Poly was really good for cocaine sales, you know. So I did that so I could drink more, et cetera. So by the time I got here, I was always carrying a weapon. If you're coming up to talk to me, it better be business related. I have no discussion for you. And you guys started telling me and making me very uncomfortable because you would drag me to places like Denny's and Lyons and stuff after the meetings, and you'd talk at me, and you'd ask me questions, and I would give you my know-it-all answers, and you would call me on my shit, and by the end of the meal, I'm backed up in the corner of that booth, wanting to kill you. And you guys wouldn't let up. You weren't afraid of me. You didn't care what I thought about you. And you would just finally tell me, you know, you're going to have to talk in order to make it here. And I said, I'll think about it. And what ended up happening was in the beginners meeting, one day the guy got up, and this was about October of 86, and he mentioned what his vocation was. He just happened to mention that he was an attorney. And I looked up, and the voice in my head said, finally, somebody worthy of me listening to them. And I started to listen. And I don't ever want to forget that. There's not any particular pearl of AA wisdom that got to me. It just happened to be that person's vocation. And so I started listening to him. And on November 24th, 1986, I got kicked out of the psychiatrist's office being told, literally, quote, you're a hopeless drunk. And I don't think anything will work for you. But you're wasting my time and I won't have it. And get out. And I went to the only place that wasn't kicking me out, which was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to group 3, and that night a young lady picked out my sponsor for me. And I went up to that woman and I said, she told me to come ask you if you'll sponsor me. I've been coming here for a long time. I'm still drunk, but if you want to, that's fine with me. And she took out a piece of paper. She wrote her first and last name, her address. You don't know me. You should not be giving me your address. I like what Patty said last night. I go shopping in your shit. I need an extra blouse. Let me go to somebody's house and take it. And she wrote down her phone number and call anytime and underlined it twice, and I still have that in my big book. I called her late that evening or early the next morning, however you look at it, and she said, what is it? And I said, I don't know how to go to sleep without a drink. And she said, you got a fridge? I said, yep. She said, well, I know Regina moved in there, and so one of you women, these smiley, happy to be sober women, had moved into my home and taking all the alcohol out. And I was like Patty too. I drank rubbing alcohol, I drank taboo, I know what taboo tastes like. I was totally like jonesing when she was talking last night. And I said, yeah. She said, well, go to the fridge and get something to drink. And I did, and I came back. I said, I got a glass of juice. And she goes, good, now you have something to drink. Go to sleep. And that has worked for me for 25 years. What they taught me was, I'm an alcoholic. However I drank when I was out there is probably how I'm going to drink in sobriety. And I always had a drink. And I always have a drink. I have two with me right now. The other thing they taught me when I was new was any thought you have after 10 p.m., don't act on it. Don't friggin' act on it. And if it's really good, just write it down and bring it to us tomorrow. Oh, I was forever sharing with those people. Look, this is my idea. And like, yeah, have a seat. We'll bring you some coffee. The things that have worked, the things that have worked have been the things that are AA tradition. And I am a traditionalist in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm still a little put off with all the clapping. You know, they didn't clap when I got here. There's no clapping in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't freaking clap. You know, it's like you share and you sit down and we appreciate it and we move on. And I got that sponsor. Group 3 signed me up and made themselves my home group. Everybody made sure I had not just the big book and the 12x12, but that I had AA Comes of Age, Dr. Bob, and the Good Old Timers, and that I read them. One of my favorite lines comes out of one of those other books. This guy is getting released from the hospital, from the alky ward, and he runs up to Sister Ignatius, I think was her name, and he goes, Sister, I'm getting out tomorrow, pray for me. And she goes, I will, my son, but why don't you pray for yourself? There's nothing God likes more than the sound of a strange voice. And it made it legit for me to start talking to a God that I absolutely hated. I did not believe in a God. I absolutely believed in a God. But I hated God because of the stuff that happened to me. You know, when gangsters get pissed, they get violent. And I have broken bones. I have a dislocated jaw. I had all kinds of wounds that never got medical treatment. I was pissed when I got here. There was a lot that went on. I mean, I came from the upper side of the dollar bill. I had to friggin' pay for my own Cal Poly experience. It was not fair. and what they did immediately was they threw me into service. They made me make coffee, and I screwed it up, and it was coming out of the top of the machine. And coming from a background like mine, I was kind of scared. And this old-timer lady, Ray Fox, walked up, and she just goes, oh, let me show you how to do it. And so she showed me how to do it. You guys show us how to do things, and I appreciate that. The other thing they did was, at 2 years sober, my best thinking was I should get pregnant. And so I did, with a friend of mine in the program, we're still friends to this day. He called this morning, he and his wife, and they called to say, did you ever think we'd be here this long? You know, his birthday is December 8th. He'll be 25. An ex-crankster. We were a pair. And so I get pregnant. We get pregnant. And I went to the old timers because they told me I couldn't work at a certain point because I was cleaning houses. You can't inhale the fumes, but I love up and shit. But you can't when you're pregnant. And so they said, go to central office and volunteer. So I went to central office and volunteered. And then I was at central office. That was kind of boring because a lot of old timer dudes, and they just sat around and talked. I didn't understand what they were saying. I was like 25 years old. And so, and I was really hyper, really hyper. I'm toned down now. and so they said, there's this thing called ACIPOC, go join that. And so I did. I was on the 89 ACIPOC committee. And our chairperson, Gary, just celebrated 35 years this year. Tom is 26. Janice is 27. Mick is 25, like me. We're still friggin' here. Are you getting the point? Get in the service. The YPA service has saved my life. My home group is a too young group in Sacramento. I love my home group, and I am the treasurer for SACIPA. I'm still in it. So if you want to know how you get time, you stay in it. You stay in it. And anyway, so do all that work. Boy, because I'm at the end of my time, aren't I? Oh, 5 minutes? Oh, yeah. Anyway, so I do all that work. You listen to the way I say it. I do all that work for that year leading up to the conference in Sacramento, and it gets to conference time. That Friday I went into labor, missed the whole conference. So I give birth. You think, oh, yeah, it's fabulous. You know, they said they looked into the eyes of God. I did not have that experience. And because it was, I'm an addict, you know, and I'm an ex-speed fiend, and the dad's a crankster, and we had decided we weren't doing any meds. And so I'm sitting there, and it's overwhelming. And all of a sudden, and this is the other thing, if I carry any message consistently, this is it. Believe in the miracles. Expect them. Expect them. And so I'd had a lot of experiences, and so I'm there, and I'm beginning to think, maybe I should give in to the drugs, you know what I mean? And this voice is in my ear, this female voice, and she says, hi. I'm a nurse here at this hospital. I was getting off shift, but I saw your chart because in red across it is written, no narcotics, no alcohol. She said, so I figured maybe you were a member of the fellowship, and I thought I'd stop in because I heard you yelling. And I wanted to let you know that there's something you can use that's totally non-narcotic that'll just take a little of the edge off and so you don't have to yell so loud. And I thought, thank you, God. You know, at the exact moment when I think my ass is falling off, I'm going to have to make a choice that's going to involve drugs, something always happens. Always happens. So that little girl was born, and 8 pounds, 11 ounces, 5.5 hours of labor, and and she will be 23 years old in January. And what happened was I had her in the room for like an hour, and her dad and I both, we knew where we came from, and we knew what we did. I didn't just carry a gun, I used a gun at all. And I didn't just use it on strangers. My dad died in 83, but while I was bottoming out, I went back to my mom's house for a little bit, and I did a lot of damage to her. And I did a lot of damage to people. And so I had that baby for an hour, and then they came in and took her. And they said, we got to take her and put her, her heart's bad, and we got to put her in this thing. And so they put her in this, like, glass box, and there were tubes, and there was all this shit. And I went and looked once, and I couldn't go back. And I laid there in that bed, and the first thing that dawned on me was, because I was like, shit, I should be at the conference. I don't get to, you know, all that work. And it dawned on me one more time, God knows me better than any human being will ever know me, even me. And God knew my ego. And you guys have made it clear to me that this whole deal here is not about clapping for me. It's about saying, Dorian, when you were sharing, that was a lie. Or Dorian, when you said, he's calling me on my shit. In the first edition of the Big Book, there's a part where it talks about we listen to each other. And we tell each other what we hear. We share what you're doing or what we see you're doing. Doc and them used to always say, we don't just watch newcomers tromp off into a pond full of alligators. Before they take that step, we pull them back and say, there's fucking alligators in there. And then we let them go. They want to go and take it, take the risk. Take the risk. That's your business. But at least we've told you there's alligators. And then after that, I couldn't go see that baby, and I wanted to die. I literally wanted to die. And I looked out the window, and I started making deals with that God. And I told that God that, you know what? I've had a life beyond your wildest imagination. I mean, I have done shit that people don't get to do, and I've done stuff people shouldn't do. But I've had a full life. I have no problem with dying in this moment. Let that baby live. And I wanted to die, and her dad kept coming and trying to get me to eat, and I wouldn't eat. And finally, thank God for, you know, Medi-Cal, and this doctor I ended up having was this 6-foot-tall black woman with this little short fro. I mean, she was huge, right? And she came in and she drug me out of the bed, and she walked me down the hallway, and I'd escape her every once in a while and run. It was crazy. If you'd been in the hospital, I mean, get mercy. Anyway, and I'd escape. No, I'm not going to go. And she grabbed my ass, and she kind of put me in a headlock, you know, just right here, tucked me in. And she walked me down there, and she made me look. And she made me look. And I believe God sent me yet another angel. And she said, that little thing right there relies upon you for her life. And I've never had anybody rely upon me for their life. And those parents I have, when I tried relying upon them for my life, they did me wrong. You know, my mom watched and my dad beat the shit out of me and tortured me. You know. And so all I ever had was me. And I looked at that little thing and I said, I can't. And she said, you can. I said, I can't. She said, you will. I said, I won't. She said, you will now. And I sat in that rocking chair and I began to breastfeed that baby. And, you know, I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous for thinking that I was worth saving.
I shouldn't be here. I knew by the time I was 16 I wouldn't see 30. You don't do what I do and run where I run and make it to 30. And I get to be 25 years sober. And I get to be 50 years old. And you guys let me keep coming back. So if you're new here, you have no friggin' idea what's in store for you. You got ideas. You got real damn good ideas. I love when you share them with me. You know? I got them too. But if I had gotten what I thought I wanted, I would have been jacked up. And there have been times I've forced my will, and it sucks to clean that up sober. I'm just saying. But more often I've gotten what I didn't even know I wanted. They say, for the next door to open, you got to take your finger out of the last door. And remember that as you trudge this road of happy destiny. Thank you for sharing my birthday with me.
Now I'd like to introduce Paul H. from Los Angeles.
I'm Paul, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
What's up?
We love you, Paul. Lots and lots and lots. Oh,
I want to personally thank whoever made the pelvic thrust at the end. That's the guy. It had to have been a guy. It might have been a girl, but that's the guy that I want to know when that happened. That was probably after all night, a lot of black coffee, and like, we should throw a pelvic thrust on the end. You know? That's what I think about, because I'd be like, I don't know who did this bullshit, but we don't need that. We just need a thrust at the end to really cap it off. You guys are going to wake up and realize you're sober and you're lucky, and I'm going to come out there and pray with each and every one of you. I don't know what I'm going to do. You know what? Too bad, Dorian. Happy 25 years. That's amazing. We can go home. We can go back to our rooms. They don't care. They're like, whatever. All right. Time's dinner. When's the dance? Right? You can go hear the old timers. When's the dance? And so, like I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober April 27th, 1986, 25 and a half years or whatever the hell that is, and I'm 41 years old. I got sober when I was 16, and I remembered I got sober in April, and in September I was in this like lockdown adolescent facility, and they took us from Boston to downtown Boston, where they had the International Young People's of AA convention. It was like the national convention was in Boston, so I was there. And like I was from there to like lockdown to like a convention like this where everyone's doing the like, we love you, Paul, whatever they were doing or whatever it was in 86. I mean, I'm sure there was a whoop, there it is time and all that stuff. You know, just tagging it on, and when they read things, it's like last night, whatever that was, that's awesome. You know what I mean? Like whoever did that is awesome, because I instantly got that, like when someone's like, you know, step two, whatever, I get that. It's just like old timers are like, hey, shh, and they're like, no, you shh, dude, this is our convention, you know, whoop your ass. And so it's like, this taps right into that mentality. So I remember they took us to this like big Park Plaza hotel in downtown Boston, and there's just people everywhere going crazy. And I am just like, what the hell, what is this? You know what I mean? I had been to some panels where people would come in and like talked at me and like lockdown, like, you're not going to stay sober and people die and blah. And so I didn't really have a good impersonation of feeling of what the hell AA even was. You know, and I went to this young people's convention and I was like, all right, I think I can get with this. It was a little much for me at the time, but I was like, wow. And so I come here all these years later, still sober, and I love the old-timer. I don't know if have you ever used that word yourself? I'm an old-timer? As an old-timer? I'm going to start using it every goddamn day. Well, as an old-timer, do you want gas or not, sir? You know what I mean? Just use it with everybody I meet, and it's like, yeah, right, exactly, like in every context, and it's like, I got to tell you something, I love being here right now. I don't care if anybody listens or not. I think this is awesome. I love being sober, and I'm just going to spout for the next 15 minutes, and it might make sense, it might not, but trust me, I am beyond grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it, you know? And I mean, that's it. I go home. Live in Hollywood, California. I speak all the time. This thing works. You know, I get it. I was on the phone in the parking lot with a sponsee. He was worried his penis was no longer working. I guess you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. When someone's going to go, but you can relate. Ah. So, old man. And, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Why would I want to ask you if your penis is working? That doesn't make any sense. So I said, your sponsee's penis were, I would imagine that would get me pulled off the panel and stop record. And it's like, maybe at the older conventions that would, but at the young people's convention, that's a legitimate, like, discussion. You know? Like, I can't, I it works. I talked them back into it working. I don't know how, but basically, I did. If you're wondering for that part of the story, it's like, it's in your head, just breathe, don't drink Red Bull. You know, that's something that's technical. You might get that, no, but it's true. And so, it's like, just to give you a couple of minutes, and then I'm going to talk more about this thing that I'm going through right now, is that, you know, I'm from Boston. I got sober at 16. I don't know what you want to know. I'm not gonna. I don't have time to give you a whole story. I can just give you a couple highlights. But like, I was like, growing up, I was the baseball guy. I was the football guy. I thought I was gonna play in the NFL. That was it. That was my life. I was gonna be a jock and I guess pick on people in high school. I guess that was the plan. And so, just lost everything by the time I was 16. Just could not stop drinking and using drugs. I just. Couldn't get how life worked. If that makes sense. Like, I couldn't understand when someone's like, okay, take it down a notch. I didn't know what, I thought that meant, like, burn that person's house down. I really didn't understand, like, oh, I should calm down a little bit or something. I never understood, like, he plays well with others. I never played well with others. My desk was always next to the teachers. I was always in the principal's office. I was always being explained what dyslexia and ADD was and all this stuff. And I'm like, you should explain ADD really quickly because I only have a couple seconds here. And I would be like, that's hilarious. I am fucking hilarious. These people should acknowledge my hilarity. And all I would do is get my dad brought in to yell at me and you can't talk to teachers like that. And I'd be like, I don't think, I want the people that go, dude, that's funny. You're a funny guy. That is hilarious, that ADD comment. No one was on that. They were just on the, you need to just calm down. You just need to, like, get your life together. You just need to buckle down. And I'm like, it wasn't even like I processed it and rejected it. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking. I have no idea what the hell you're talking about. I don't want to go to college. I don't want to do anything. I just want to get on a football field and hit people as hard as I can. And because I'm scared, but I am not in touch with that right now. I am just macho because I am 12 and it's on. And so, and I like Fruity Pebbles. I used to eat those all the time, and Captain Crunch. That was something that was a developing issue quickly in my life that existed till this morning. And so this shit's really good, and I'm going to keep eating it, and that's just going to be the way it is. And then I started drinking and smoking pot and taking diet pills and all this great stuff, and I went out of my mind, and I got thrown out of school, and I got put in lockdown, and then I got taken to AA. There it is. 16. Boston. Suburbia. Church basements. Nobody's young. The next youngest person was like 30. I'm like, that dude is fucking old. And I'm like 16. I roll into this meeting, and there's some guy taking a cake for 23 years of sobriety. 23 years. He's like 60-something years old. I'm like, I wonder if that's long enough to be a sponsor, because I know I got to get one of those sponsor guys. And so there's this woman I knew from the bank that was there. And she said, you should ask, he would be a good sponsor for you, sweetie. So I was like, that's a good idea. So I went right up, and I tapped his shoulder, and there was a long line, he was taking a cake. There was a long line of people congratulating him. I was like, I didn't even see the line. I mean, if you're, half of you in here don't even know what a line is. People are like, hey man, you cut the line. You're like, dude, I'm wearing the name tag. That's about as much fucking conforming as I'm going to do this weekend. Do an F your line, old timer. You know what I mean? Why don't you take a nap and wait for the blue plate special. And so, old man. Take a nap, Grandpa. And so the three of you that understand are really understanding. And you know what? You're the three I'm talking to. There's a few dudes in here that are like, yes. A lot of people are like, I don't really get this guy. I don't know what this guy is. You know what I mean? Well, I don't have to sponsor you. I sponsor those dudes. You know what I mean? So I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he says yes. And yes. I said, awesome. And I go to leave, and he goes, "What's your name, me boy?" Scott. Scott is like, "All right, take it down a notch." And so I said, "Paul." See? And he said, "My name's Warren." And he said, "We start next week." So I was like, "Yes." So I left there. I went home, told my dad, who's drinking. My dad drove me there. It's a long story. But basically, he dropped me off, and I get in the car, and I'm like, "I got a sponsor. His name's, he's the greatest guy. He's going to save my life." And my dad's like, "Well, what's his name?" I'm like, "Well, I don't know." I don't remember his name. But we're going to meet him there next week. And I went home, and I went to bed, and I got up for school the next day. It's Thursday morning, and I just got let back into school, by the way. I was gone for a year because I was the kid that was sent away, that was locked up, that was the freak, that was the weirdo that comes back to society and goes, "Oh yeah, that's the kid that's..." You know? Yeah, that kid, you know? Well, people are like, "Wow, if I got sober at 16, that'd be rad." And they're like, "Yeah, you lived through that." I mean, yeah, I get the 25 years in the fucking parade. Start there. When you wake up on a Thursday morning and nobody fucking likes you. You go back to school where people are like, "Dude, you robbed me. You fucking beat my buddy up. You're an asshole. I hate you." No one's like, "Hey, you're back. Welcome home. You're sober." We don't know what the fuck that is. You know what I mean? We're 16. Nobody knows what that is. And it's like, you know what I mean? If you're young and you're in this room, it's like you got to explain to people what recovery is like. Because it took me 30 years. I haven't got it yet, but I'll get it eventually. And it's just like, I started over, and I remember all I would think all day was, "I'm going next week to that meeting, and I'm going to meet my sponsor. I have to get there early. My sponsor's going to be there." My dad comes home from work. I'm like, "Remember next week?" He's the worst. "Son, I'll get you there early." Every day I reminded him. Every day. For a week. And so when people go, how do people stay sober? How do young people stay sober? How do they do it? You say, "I can't explain it to you. I don't know why you take a dude that is an animal that should be locked up for a long time for the stuff that you were talking about. But he's going to bed every day making sure that he's on time next week to meet some old dude in some fucking church parking lot." And that's what's keeping him alive all week. Who knows? When most people hear Bill Wilson, they just go, "Huh?" But we just like go, "Wow, yeah." Do you know what I mean? I heard a quote about Bill Wilson recently that somebody said, "Bill, you can't save everybody." And he said, "Yeah, but I might have to just die trying." When there was like an 8-hour train ride and someone was going to take to Delaware, and Bob's like, "Bill, we can't save everyone." And Bill's like, "Bob, we have to die trying." Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Maybe we have to die trying. Go to the, my dad comes home on that Wednesday. I'm like, "Dad, we got to get home early. My sponsor, we're going to meet my sponsor. He's going to be there." And I don't even know if he's going to, but I want to get there early to prove to him that I really want this thing. Because everyone had told me I did at that point. And I didn't know. When you're that young, you don't fucking know. When you're 40 and you're new, you don't know. You just don't know. You're like, "What is this thing? I don't know. I'm just sick of the life I had. I want what that dude has up there that's speaking now. It's like laughing and seems high. That guy's rad." And so I want what that dude has. That dude, does that dude hate us? What's going on there? Like, kind of. And so my dad drops me off. I go in the parking lot and there's my sponsor. Standing there. It's like 12 degrees in Boston. It's freezing cold. It's like February. And I was like, "Wow, I wonder what he's doing in the parking lot." And I walk up to him and he's like, "Hey, kid, I was waiting for you just in case you showed up." And I was like, "You wait for me?" And he's like, "Yeah. I know." I'm not sure giggles is the right response, but I'll go with it. And so, there's one good giggles in every crowd. I love it. And so, and he told me like years later, months later, when he was training me to work with new guys, he said, "Hey kid, in AA we strike first. When that kid asks you for help, if you can prove to him that you want nothing from him but to help him, you give that dude just that speck of hope that this thing might work." And that's what he did. You know, and that's what I did in the parking lot. And I was like, oh, dude, that thing will work again. Don't worry. I gave the penis. And so, because the thing is like, the thing that I don't hear enough in AA, the thing that I don't hear about, like, the old timers, the thing I don't hear these people talk is it's like, there are a lot of dudes in here that have been in my home that people in the neighborhood are like, whoa, dude's tatted head to toe. That, like, come in my house, like, thank you, brother. Then I watch them beat people half to death in parking lots at meetings. Dudes that wouldn't even think of saying anything other than sir to me because they're like, they want what we have. Do you know what I mean? Because they've sat with us and they're like, they see it. They see it. I can tell people, dude, I've been arrested. I've been fucking caught drug smuggling. I've beat people fucking down. I've fucking been fired. I've lost dream jobs. And that's all sober, dog. Let's keep going. And they're like, right. And I don't live that way anymore. And I am at peace. And they're like, I want that. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't believe a dude that hasn't lived that life. I need to see it. Like, yeah, I had 7 years and I wanted to put a gun in my mouth. I did. I wanted to die. I was thinking about it. Like, how can I get out of this game called life? Because this doesn't work. And I need that connection with people. You know? I love the Young People's Convention. I love this stuff because that's what we're all in this together. You know? And there's someone in this room right now that's like, I don't know. I don't know about this thing. This isn't my last weekend, I think. I'm done. AA. Or maybe it's your first weekend. Who knows? Welcome. It's like, for me, it's been a couple minutes. Good. It took a... Yeah, I got it, got it. And so, it took a long time for me to get the beauty. But there ain't nothing to get. There ain't nothing to get. You know, it's like, for me, it's help other people, go to meetings, ask for help. That's it. Put dudes on my couch, give them hope. Life's grand. And, you know, whenever I hear people share that, I'd be like, yeah, but that dude's life's probably below this, so that's why he's so happy with that. Trust me, my life's fucking unbelievable. It's cool. It's like, wow, I want that guy's life. You know, and it's all filler for me in between just going to meetings, asking for help, and helping other people. You know? That's it. Meditation, the steps, and all that. It's all long good. A sponsor will take you through all that. But for us, it's just helping someone sit next to you like, you're right. You okay? You having a good day? Yeah? You having a good day? You guys okay? Like, that's it. You know? that's all it is. The guy in the back, hey, man, what's up? It's like, because it's like you could be going through something, and I'll be like, what's up, dog? I'll be like, well, dog, old lady's pain in the ass. All old ladies are pain in the ass. Thanks. And then you feel better. It's just like we have this connection where we understand each other, and I can't explain it. You know what I mean? I've sat in meetings for years where people get up there and they start talking and pontificating, and they want to talk about quoting the book, and I just want to yell out, shut up. Just shut up. No one cares. Look the person in the eye, tell them you've been through it, and you'll help them, call you anytime. You're here for them, and that's it. You know? I don't care what's on the bottom of page 42. I know what's on the bottom of page 42. But I can share it. I'd be doing good. I got all the basis of their life. I'd be the alternative to the face, that whole thing. And spiritual way of living. And with my last 3 minutes, I'd just like to say that Warren was an amazing man. My sponsor. Passed away when I was about 10 years sober. I moved to LA by that point and got to call him, talk to him on the phone, say goodbye. It's like I'm going to go back and see his son and just thank him to let him know what a great man his dad was. Because there's just something that I just owe it to him. I just owe it to that man. I just owe it to that man. When he died, the same like month or two, my dad got sober. It's 15 years. Just mailed his birthday card right now before the meeting. And I wrote in it, I'm proud of you, you're my dad. And I will end with this. This thing is awesome. I love it. I love everyone that tries to get it. I don't care who you are. If I can help you, I will. Man or woman, all good. We'll work it out. Get you to people that can help you. I had this dude, my best friend, always my boy for a long time. My other best friend, this kid Adam, about 11 years, 12 years ago. My boy's like, oh, this dude just got sober. We gotta go see him. We go and see him. We become friends. It's this shitty little apartment. No money. Start hanging, going to meetings. He's getting this thing. Gets a life. Ooh, that boy got a life. Every year we talk, celebrate. Gets like 10 years sober. Through a series of circumstances, he just OD'd and died. Got a plane crash, painkillers killed him. And, almost 2 years ago. And, I only say that because he had a place in New York City, a $7 million place in downtown. I mean, he was loaded and successful. I watched this dude get a huge life and be all about AA, and then just once those drugs got in the system, he couldn't do it. And, I kneeled down. Because I was there when they took his body, like 2 days later, and there's like candles and photos and all that stuff. He's like a famous guy, and I remember in New York City just getting on my knees there, crying. People walking by, and I just said, I'm so sorry. And if I could have saw it in a meeting when I was fucking around, I apologize, dude, and I promise you, I will never ever not pay attention to the people around me again. And that was the pledge I made to him, the pledge I make to you. Let's just make it to each other. Just look around. You alright, dude? You okay? Everything cool? You know, we can all make another day. So thank you. I love you. And God bless.
Next, I would like to introduce Steve M. from Seal Beach.
I am Steve, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve. Love you, Steve. Lots and lots and lots. Oh, I love you.
For the cute girls that did that, you can see me after the movie. If it's really true. Because I didn't believe anything at all when I got here. And even sometimes today, I don't believe a lot of stuff. I believe nothing you say and half of what I see. And I can't help it, that's just my makeup. I want to wish everyone a happy holidays. I do not like the holidays. I do not like doing this. I hate AA dances. I just do it because I don't want to end up drunk and dead. But the worst case for me is ending up drunk and stuck out there. And I wish that on nobody. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's nice to be up here in a suit and tie. And, you know, my sponsor told me if you know you ever know you're going to be up in front of a podium, you wear a tie. And I don't want to wear a tie this morning or today. You know, and I thought, but I brought it with me just in case. You know. And here I am, you know, sound, safe, sober. And I have a good life today. It's not always easy. And never wanted to be an alcoholic. I love drinking. And I'm sober 26 and a half years. And my first bout with AA, I was 15 years old. And like I said, I did not want to be an alcoholic. I have 9,684 days. Who's counting? But I really believe it's one day at a time. So, you know, if you can make it through one day, you can do this thing. And I never, ever, ever, I was the guy that was never going to get sober. Took me 10 years to get 1 year. And I just fought everything about this program, about... Even today, I mean, I'm not a big book thumper, I'm not a Bible thumper, I'm not even sure if I really believe in God, and I hate the holidays. And I mean, it's a little bit better now, but as I tell you a little bit about my story, you'll know why. And just to give you a little background, I come from a big Catholic family. My grandparents had like 10 kids, and they all had like 10 kids. And everyone in our family has alcoholism. And but even though I was born with alcoholism, I don't think that made me an alcoholic. And you know, my grandparents, when they came here from Germany, they ended up in a little town. My grandfather ran the saloon. It was a long time ago. Ran the saloon and the gambling hall, and my grandma ran the whorehouse. And those are my social skills today. That's what I'm working with. And you know, it's kind of funny because my son came up with me, and he's only 17. He talked me into going to the casino, and we didn't get here till like 7 in the morning. And I woke up just like hungover. But we had a good time. You know, we stopped and did Midnight Madness shopping at the Cabazon. And oh my gosh, what a nightmare. We had a good time. We stayed sober. And, you know, he's having his own little problems, and maybe I'll talk a little bit about that. But what happened with my grandpa, God love him to death, I remember as a little kid, he used to chase me around the yard. And my grandma lived to be 104. And, you know, so there was always booze around. And I thought I had a right and a privilege to drink it whatever I wanted and wherever. But the only thing is, you know, I wasn't old enough. And so I hid it. I got away with a lot. And like I said, by the time I was 15, you know, I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I was 16, I was on a court card. And I was court ordered to do 90 meetings in 90 days. So I went to 90 different meetings in 90 days. I didn't want to be like you people. And I just couldn't imagine life without alcohol, because I thought alcohol made me better. Made me have dreams, just made me do everything better. And, you know, what happened to me in and out of AA for years and years. Christmas. I was raised Catholic. Christmas, we always had big parties, but they all ended up in fights. Drama. Christmas, 1984. Long damn time ago. Our house caught on fire Christmas morning. My dad and my brother died in the fire. So me, I'm thinking, there's no God. If there is, fuck God. You know? And what happened was, I went on a drunk for 6 straight months. I don't even think I drew a sober breath. I was in my early 20s. And I finally got to that place where the book talked about, that jumping off place. And I had nowhere to go. I exhausted everything. Halfway houses, friends, family. And I decided to give Alcoholics Anonymous a chance. And, you know, I'm a real big first step worker, especially the first half being powerless over alcohol. If you're new and alcohol is still working for you, I feel for you. You know, because there's nothing but an act of God that can really save you or save anybody. And for me, that was a big thing to swallow, because, you know, I didn't believe in this God deal. And so I bought a little bit of the program, and all of a sudden God started showing up everywhere, and I was just like, forget this, I'm out of here. And they told me, give it 90 days and we'll gladly refund your ticket to misery. And what happened was, day 90, I was miserable, and I drank. And what happened was, for the first time in my life, I could see where taking that drink, I couldn't stop. Because I always, you know, just tried to maintain my drinking. I'd always end up drunk or in a blackout. For the first time in my life, I could actually see, just like, I couldn't stop. And so I came back to AA. I didn't say anything for a year. I just sat in meetings. It took me 5 years to get a sponsor. And, I mean, I did it the hard way. You guys don't have to do it that way. I don't drink the coffee. I don't eat the donuts. I don't smoke cigarettes. I don't say that because I'm better than you guys. It's just when I got here, I was so sick and I was puking. My system couldn't handle it. And, but I sit here today. I'm 26 and a half years sober, and I have a good life today. It's not always easy, and I have a lot going on. I have 6 kids. I have a couple different businesses. Had to close a couple of them in the last few weeks. And, everyone's struggling right now. But, being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and having people around me, it makes it easier. And what I did, I finally found a home group. I found a sponsor, my home group, Pacific Group in L.A. Every Wednesday night, about 800 to 1,000 people meet. It's one of the largest meetings in the world. And the thing is my sobriety, I'm like a baby in that meeting. There's a lot of time and a lot of sobriety, and I know almost every single person in that meeting, and they call me by name and they shake my hand, and there's so much love in that room. I'm just blown away, even today, because I got here thinking that no one loved me, no one cared about me. And that's all I really needed, because my parents didn't give me love, and I just thought, well, if I had that love, that I'd somehow be okay. And what I found out is it's not the love that I need. It's like our last guy that shared, it's doing that love and that service for the other person. And as I started doing that, I got involved in H&I. I spoke last night in a meeting in Lakewood. I don't like doing this. I just don't. I dread it, really. But I know it saves my life. And it gives me a chance to live in that outside world. I make a lot of mistakes. I mean, ask my son. He's probably got a whole different story than what I'm saying. He's probably thinking, oh, he's up there bullshitting again. But I tell you, he's 17 years old, and he's checking this thing out, and he's drinking, and I started him riding a motorcycle when he was really young, about 7 years old, and he got pretty good at it. He crashed 3 times. He's in a state race for the championship. He crashed 3 times in the race, and my heart just fell. He still came in second though, and. And now he's got, well, let's not talk about some motorcycles, but he's got all the stuff that he needs to be successful. He started drinking, he started getting injured, and he lost his goals and his desires, and I try to set an example for him. Sometimes it's really hard, because even though he's not old enough to drink, he has that right to drink. No one can take that away from anybody. So I'm trying to help him see that, he's really an alcoholic and he has these problems, that Alcoholics Anonymous works. Had a little bit of money, I pitched in, and we bought him a nice truck, and he's taking it out four-wheel driving a couple times, both times he wrecked it. And a couple weeks ago, he got his first DUI. And he wasn't actually in the car, but that's what he got. I never got a DUI when I was out there drinking. Even though I drove drunk all the time, I could have killed someone. My oldest son's 24, 25. He's in jail for 7 years right now for killing someone drunk driving. And I do not want this to happen to my other son, and I hope he sees that. So he's here this weekend checking this out. And, not all of us make it. When I got sober, my older brother was sober 2 years, and he's been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 30 years. I think he's got 3 days. My other brother tried to get sober with me. He had a couple of months. He went out, he OD'd, and he died. All my friends in AA, most of them, I used to go to a lot of young people's meetings when I was new. We used to pack these meetings. I mean, where's everyone at now? I mean, I'm not trying to scare anyone or anything, but here I'm sitting 26 years later, all my friends that I've met in AA are all dead drunk. And, you know, it's not a rosy picture out there. So I feel I'm a fortunate survivor. And I do that by going to my meetings, taking commitments. I'm sponsoring one guy right now, but, you know, the book says, the book says that, you know, we are beyond human aid. That scares the shit out of me, really, to be honest with you. Because I still struggle with this God thing. And, but today I'm willing. I mean, I'm like that guy who wrote his Doubting Thomas. I mean, I want to see the holes in Jesus' palms, and, you know, I want to prove that he was nailed to the cross. And, I haven't got it yet, but I tell you, you know, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is I say those little prayers that AA has that they tell you to say. You know, my sponsor, everyone that he sponsors, he makes a requirement that you get that little AA book and you read it every morning. And, you know, I started waking up, you know, feeling pretty good about life. And like I said, I had a couple of different businesses. I've been pretty much kind of successful. It's been kind of hard with the economy. I was renting one of my houses. This guy came up to the, and I grew up very, very poor. This guy came up to the door and he's, "Hi, I'm a pastor." And thinking that he was going to get some juice for me, I started out telling him, I go, "I'm atheist." And his jaw just dropped. You know, an atheist is you don't believe in God, but I was just kind of joking with him. And, you know, because out in the business world, I've worked in a bank for a long time, and I'm involved in some other businesses. I don't go out and say, "Oh, I'm an alcoholic." People don't know. But the thing is I'm like at the top of my profession. People don't have the faintest idea that I come to AA. I mean, if I see someone there having a problem, you know, I might slip them some literature or something, but I don't involve my outside work with my AA. And so this pastor's telling me, yeah, he goes, "They have a funeral home and a mortuary too," and I'm like, I tell him, "Oh, you save him and then you bury him." I tell you, this guy is a character. I ran his credit. He's just like, he's like a criminal on paper. And he's preaching to all these people telling him about God. And that's what I grew up with. People saying things but not doing what they're saying. So it kind of leads me to that position. It's like, you know, people come up here and they talk all this good program or they say this and that. But I watch. You know, I watch people, and that's how I find out, you know, what's really going on. And in my home group and Pacific group, there's some good sobriety, and they're doing the deal. And they're very busy. You know, Friday night is a mid-stag, and we're affiliated with the mission, so we take all the newcomers to the meeting after, all the newcomers to the movies after the meeting. Saturday we meet at Clancy's house. We call it the yard. We play softball. We have a barbecue. Saturday evening we have a meeting. Sunday we have our parties. One of her sponsors, baby's party. Sunday we have two parties on Sunday, and it keeps me busy because even though I'm pretty much, you know, they say our disease centers in our mind. I'm pretty much my mind. You know, this is telling me, bring your body and the mind will follow. Bring the body and your mind will follow. It's like, I've always tried to get rid of my mind. I knew that was my problem. You know, today I have a good, strong mind today. I set goals. I put down my wants and needs on paper, and I set goals, and I reach those goals. And sometimes I amaze myself. So if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't really demand anything of you. Doesn't cost any money. We don't push God on you. We don't push the steps on you. If someone does, you know, find someone else. You know, that's what I did. And I've been able to stay here. Thank you.
Debbie A. from La Quinta.
Hi, Debbie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Debbie. We love you, Debbie. Lots and lots and lots. Oh, Debbie.
Thank you. I love you guys, too, and I'm glad to be here. And I'd like to thank Dorian and Steve and Paul for sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, my story is a little different, but very common also. I started drinking at a very young age. I don't even remember when I had my first drink, but I was real sickly. I was in the hospital as a baby. I had pneumonia, and I coughed a lot. So every time I coughed, they'd just give me medicine. And I still cough a lot, and I think I'm secretly hoping for medicine. Where's that medicine? And I remember my mom just always giving me medicine and just sitting there like a little bird. Oh, I love that medicine. And I found out later that was actually brandy. It wasn't even a drink. Because I was trying to find a cough medicine in the store when I was older. I'm like, where is that good stuff? And like, yeah, it's not cough medicine. But anyway, it did help my cough, and it helped me to sleep, and it just kept me quiet. And that was pretty much, I'm sure, what my parents were trying to figure out, just keep her quiet. And I was a lot like Paul. I was very ADD, hyper, and I was restless, irritable, and discontent from the time I remember. And I bit my nails. I was nervous. My parents were always constantly fighting, and I grew up in Minnesota. And they sent us to the basement where everything echoes, you know. So it sounds like really bad. I mean, the fights were horrendous, and furniture got thrown. You know, there were always somebody was busting their ankle or arm or whatever. And I remember just being horrified, just being in the basement, like, oh, God, what's happening? You know, just and you know, I needed to drink from the time I can remember. And you know, I tried everything. As a child, I just wanted out of the moment. I hated the pain I felt. I felt constant, irritable feelings. And any time, I mean, I'd sniff, drink, push, whatever. I just was like a garbage can. And, you know, I have two older sisters, and they introduced me to a lot of things. And I was a guinea pig at home, and I'd try anything, and they'd laugh and watch and point, and you know, and I was like, more, bring it. I didn't care what I took. I put anything in my mouth, and you know, just looking for that effect, just trying to get out of the moment. And when I drank, I blacked out right away from the very beginning. And you know, as I my first alcohol experience drinking on my own was. Went for a bike ride, and I crashed. Somebody ran into me. Well, I was riding on the highway, which was a problem. But and they brought me home, and I don't remember it. I don't remember crashing my bike. I just remember, you know, being all bloody and bruised up, and they threw me in the shower with all my clothes on, and I remember being angry that, like, you know, why would they do that to me? You know, what's going on? And they're like, you're drunk, and. And I remember just thinking, like, so what? Like, why would you wear my clothes like this? You know, and it was just, I was angry, and I was sad, and filled with just terrible, lonely feelings, and I didn't want to feel anything. When I was 7, my parents separated, and I just remember crying myself to sleep, every night. I was sad, and I missed my mom, and my mom was an alcoholic, and she was doing her thing. And when I was 12, I ran away from home. My father was very abusive, and the abuse had kind of turned on me. And I got out of there and ran away and hitchhiked, and my neighbor picked me up. And I remember thinking, like, what luck, like, that the neighbor has to pick me up, of all people. And you know, today, looking back, I see God's grace in my life and how he's protecting me, you know. But at the time, I felt very unfortunate, you know, that these things would happen. And I went to live with my mom, and my mom had stopped drinking. She'd gone to AA, and I didn't like her anymore. She wasn't fun. She wasn't a party animal. You know, she wasn't having parties at her house, and now she's going to meetings. And And I'm in my disease, and I'm playing off her guilt, and I wouldn't come home for days at a time. And she'd tell me to come home, you need to be home at this time, and I'd just be like, what? Like, I'm 13, I'm 14. I remember just thinking, looking at her, you want me to be home at what time? Are you kidding me? And I had a major attitude with her, and it worked, and she let me stay out later, and I did things I shouldn't have done. I was places where a young girl shouldn't have been, and bad things happened, and as I was out one time, there was an accident in town, and several kids got rolled their vehicle, and two boys died, and a girl was in the back seat in a catatonic state in the hospital, and they wouldn't disclose the name until the parents were notified, so my mom went to the police to see if it was me, the police couldn't believe that she didn't know where her daughter was for several days, and how could, what kind of a parent are you, and we'll find your daughter, and I remember coming to, trying to find my clothes in the alley, and there were cops going up and down the alley, and I knew they were looking for me, and I always thought they were the bad guys, and I loved that excitement, I remember, getting home and trying to take a bath, and just, I felt so disgusting. I felt like, I couldn't get the ickiness off of me, and I had this hole in my gut that I didn't want to live. And my mom found me and took me to Arizona, and we went to a convention that was in Phoenix. And she was trying to find a place for me while she finished up her. She was getting a counseling degree, which was ironic. And she knew I had a problem. And she tried to get me to go to meetings, but I felt I was too young because I was only 14. And she took me to this young people's convention in Phoenix, and or young people's speaker. And this woman, Gloria D. from Long Beach, shared. And she shared about her feelings and about feeling hopeless and empty and having that degrading feeling. And everything she talked about, I related to her, and I didn't want to relate to her. I sat there with my arms crossed, and my mom kept looking over at me like, are you getting it? And I just thought, screw you. I don't want to hear any of this stuff, but something started to melt into my heart. And this woman touched my heart, and I've heard in these meetings that this is the language of the heart. Where the heart speaks, the heart listens. And my heart opened up that day, and I related to this woman, and I went up to her afterwards, and I told her I related to her, and she gave me a little card with praying hands, and she said, call, and she told me about a recovery house she knew of out in Desert Hot Springs, and where kids could go, but my mom had other plans. She wanted to put me in a religious home, so I went to this religious home, but for some reason I kept that little card in my pocket, and as I was in this home, they told me that I was possessed. And I remember thinking that there was something deeply wrong with me. And so when they said that, you're possessed and you have demons, that I thought, well, yeah, I know I have something in me. And I was sitting there, and they were laying hands on me and praying, remove this from this child. And I remember just being like, get out of me. Quit tormenting me. Leave me alone. And after they were done, I just thought, I need a drink. I need something. I can't feel this anymore. It was that raw pain was right there. And I ran out of that place as soon as the door opened. It was a locked facility. But I knew they'd come in with groceries, and I tore out of there. And somehow I kept that woman's phone number, and I ended up hiding out in the bushes, and a guy on a bike went by and rode on his handlebars, and it was just crazy. And I remember just all that excitement and thinking this was the bad guys. I always felt like the cops were the bad guys, even though I didn't realize they were really actually trying to protect the kids, that I was with the bad guys. And I ended up calling that woman from this guy. I lived in a garage for a while, and they didn't know I was living in a garage. And I called this woman, and she wired me a bus ticket. I met her one time, and she wired me a bus ticket from Phoenix to California, and I came out here when I was 14, and she took me to this recovery house. I stayed there for about 30 days, and they sent me out on a little job and paid me cash, and I went and got drunk. And they said, you can't stay here. You can't drink and stay here. You're out. And I remember just praying to God, like, oh, God, what is wrong with me? Like, why do I keep doing things knowing that I have no other options left? What is wrong with me? I know there's something seriously not right. And that was the day I believed that I surrendered, and I asked, and they gave me another chance. They said that they let me stay. That was November 5th of 1976, and that was my last drink. And, you know, I don't know, everybody has shared, like, how do we do this? You know, I got a sponsor. My sponsor took me through the steps, and I started giving it away. And she said, you know, now it's your turn to work with other people. And you know, when somebody asked me to be their sponsor, you know, I feel that it's an honor and a privilege. Whenever somebody asks me to speak in a meeting, it's an honor. It's, you know, a privilege. It's the gift I've been given. You know, I was sober a few years when I got married when I was 18, and I had a child when I was 19. And, you know, that child grew up not ever seeing anything except for sobriety in her life. And she, you know, my daughter was, she's going to be 30. I didn't think I'd make it to 30. Somebody shared about that. You know, I really never even thought I'd make it to 16 because the way I was living was rough, and it was, you know, it was difficult. And anyone that gets sober young knows how hard it is. It's really hard. You guys know what I'm talking about. It's not an easy path. But you know, I had a sister that went into mental hospital when I was 9. And she never did really come out. She never made it really. She was institutionalized, and she never made it to this program. And 3 years ago, she died of cirrhosis of the liver. And she always said, you know, she was the normal one in the family. And when she died, we found her journal, and she kept her journal. And the things she wanted were things that we all have, like just ordinary things. She wanted like a house and a car, and she just wanted a peaceful life. And you know, everything that she wanted was things that I have, that I take for granted every single day. And, you know, I realized that, I just deepened my feeling that, you know, how fortunate those of us are that even made it to this program. It's not a program for those who need it, it's for those who want it. And, you know, my prayer is that you're desperate and that you want it bad enough, and, you know, that we can pass this along to those that want it. And I've seen a lot of people not make it along the way, you know, I've seen people make it, and the greatest joy in my life is watching someone else get this, you know, and doing the steps and looking at, you know, going through their inventory, clearing away the wreckage of their past, giving freely of what we find, you know, that they, and seeing those eyes open up with the newcomer. It's like the greatest blessing in my life. A few years ago, I met my husband, and we got married, and we were able to go and travel around to other countries, and we went to meetings. As soon as we got there, we'd look up where the meetings were, and we had friends all over the place. You know, even though nobody spoke our language, there were people that we'd find an AA meeting that spoke English, you know, English-speaking meetings, what a blessing, you know, just, we have friends everywhere. They help us find our, you know, get our metro passes and all kinds of stuff, and, you know, we're able to go back and visit some of them. And, you know, there's only in this program is where we find this kind of friendship, this kindred, you know, we have this kindred spirit. And, you know, I hated school. Like, I got kicked out of school all the time. And, you know, after I was sober a while, I went back to school myself, and I used to think it was stupid because I couldn't focus very well. And, you know, I found that I just had some learning disabilities, and I learned to work with it, and, you know, I became a teacher. And today, I've been a teacher for about 22 years. And, you know, I teach middle school, which I don't really want to do, but I know that's where God wants me, and so I show up, and I suit up, and I do the deal, and, you know, I see those little kids, I see myself in their eyes, and I see some of them, I'm saving a seat for a lot of them. Yeah, this isn't a disease that you get to choose, you get it, or I believe it's just what we have. And I'm just so glad I found a place where I don't have to be alone, I'm not weird. I always felt like a weirdo at school, like a weird, like, you know, she's different. And, you know, here I'm in a room full of a bunch of weirdos, I love that. To know that we're amongst friends, we're not alone. And you know, a few years ago, we went to New York City, and there was a homeless guy, and he was pulling a cart, pushing a cart, and we were down by 9/11, or, you know, ground zero, and it was really emotional. And but I saw this guy, and I thought, gee, what a pain. If he just, like, rolled one of those cards, his life would be so much easier. And it was like the sky opened up, and I heard his voice say, you know, like, little one, why don't you let go of some of that baggage you're carrying? And I was like, oh, that's right, it's the same thing. I mean, he has a car, I have a house, I have a garage, I got junk, I got so much stuff I don't need. And, you know, we, you know, sold our house, we just got rid of a lot of things and were able to, you know, some of it was, we didn't make any profit, it was a short sale, but it seemed like one of the hardest things I had to walk through. That year I lost my sister, my house, my job, my dog, 17 years, just a lot of losses. My sponsor, the woman who rescued me off the streets when I was 14, you know, it's a lot of losses, but what I learned from that is that, you know what, there's, somebody said, you know, you have to pry your hands out of the door behind you before the next one will open, and, you know, this life doesn't mean it's going to, being sober doesn't mean everything's going to be wonderful all the time, but we have support, we're not alone, and, you know, that aloneness is gone. You know, we don't have to walk through things by ourselves. And, you know, one of my favorite verses is from the Keys of the Kingdom, but that verse that, you know, saying that there's no more aloneness. And, you know, because I felt so alone so long, and I'm so grateful today that there is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. And that ache for me is gone, and never need return for you either. And now there's a sense of belonging, feeling wanted, needed, and loved, and return for a while when I hang over.